lecture covering the non-equivalent control group pre-test post-test design. So I did that one. I think I did that one. Pretty sure I did that one. Yeah, I guess I did. So I'm going to go ahead and go now to the fifth design. Single group time series design. A single group time series design. There's a lot of different types of these, but we're only really going to talk about one. So, a couple actually. So basically what you do is rather than take one measure of, you know, some DVs and then do some sort of intervention and then take one measure of some DVs after, what you do is you take multiple measures over a period of time before you introduce the treatment or the IV. And then after you introduce the treatment or IV, you take multiple measures after that. Why would you do that? Well, one of the reasons you want to do that is you want to make sure that there's no fluctuations over time in the DVs that you're taking. It makes it a little, since you don't have a comparison group, you know, you're just comparing one group or one population or one sample. If you take multiple measures several times before you do something, before you give a treatment or whatever, this will allow you to understand what sorts of fluctuations you're likely to encounter, and therefore any fluctuations you see after the treatment can, you know, you might be able to account for those as quote normal fluctuations instead of, you know, something due to the treatment. So what you're doing again is you're doing multiple, you're taking multiple measures to see if that behavior is stable. Then you're doing something, you know, some intervention, and then you're taking multiple measures again to see if it's stable after the treatment. So for example, for one, back in 1955, the traffic fatalities in the state of Connecticut were the highest they ever were. So basically, Connecticut issued a crackdown on speeding, and then they commissioned a psychologist named Campbell to see if the crackdown worked. And what he did essentially was this time series design. He compared the number of the fatalities before the crackdown to the number of fatalities after the crackdown. And what he found was that the number of deaths fell from 324 in 1955 to 284 in 1956. So you want to, you know, so it went from one year to the other year, right? From 1955 to 1956. So the question is, did it work? Well, you know, maybe it did, maybe it didn't. You know, maybe that reduction in accidents was part of the normal fluctuation in accident fatalities. You know, maybe you know, maybe if you were to look at it long term, you'd see that normal fluctuation. So what he did was he decided to do this this more in-depth time series design. So he got information for the traffic fatalities for the years preceding 1955. In other words, from 1951 to 1955. And for the time period after 1956 up to 1959. So basically if the number of fatalities that went down after they cracked down on speeding, if that was just due to some normal fluctuation, like regression to the mean, then you would expect the fatality number to go back up at some point. But they didn't. What he found out when he did this time series design was that the number stayed down, which meant that he could infer, not conclusively prove, because again, we don't have an experiment, but he could infer that the crackdown on speeding helped. The sixth design that we're going to talk about, so that was the single group time series design. Now the last one, the sixth one, is the called the multiple group time series design. And this is basically the same thing, but you have two or more groups. So for over two or more groups, you multiply you measure multiple times some dependent variable, and then you give an intervention to one or more of those groups, and then you measure the dependent variable again. All right, so for example, this guy Campbell, the first study that he did was with Connecticut, right? Because that was the state that had all of the fatalities, and then had the intervention of cracking down on speeding, and then he found that they had a reduction in speeding. Well, he also did the same for the same time periods. He looked at other states at the same time periods. He looked at Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York. And these states are surrounding Connecticut. And also, these states did not have a crackdown on speeding at this time. They did not have a crackdown on speeding. So he compared all four of these states, including Connecticut, with this time series thing by looking at year after year after year of fatalities. And he noticed a couple of things. First of all, he noticed that the number of fatalities stayed pretty stable across all the states, except for Connecticut. Connecticut had the reduction in fatalities, and then they stayed stable, but they had the reduction of fatalities after 1955, after they had the crackdown in speeding. So by comparing the one state of Connecticut with a bunch of other states, he was able to show that, or infer even strongly, more strongly, that the reduction in fatalities was not just due to some random fluctuation. Rather, it was probably to the enforcement of the speeding laws. Okay, so that covers all of the designs that we started talking about at the last lecture, namely the different types of quasi-experimental designs. So just to review, we did six altogether. We did the first one we talked about was the single group post-test only design. Then we talked about non-equivalent control group post-test only design. And then we talked about the single group pre-test post-test design. And then we talked about the non-equivalent control group pre-test post-test design. And then we talked about the single group time series design. That's one I just got through talking about with Connecticut. And then finally, the sixth one, multiple group time series design, which had more of Connecticut in it. So those are the six quasi-experimental designs. They're fairly straightforward. They're not too hard to understand, so. Now, finally, the last thing I want to talk about real quick, and I wish I would have had time to cover this in class because this is actually fairly useful because it's one of those things that it's one of those topics that is useful for future employment. It's something that will help. And this is the topic of program evaluation. Program evaluation, this is another type of applied research. It's very, very applied. Meaning that you're only going to be doing it in situations where, you know, there's some task or some job to be done, right? It's not research, it's applied. It has some purpose in the real world or in the work world. So since it's applied, it's very high on external validity, meaning it really matters out in the outside world. It's valid in the outside world. Program evaluation, of course, involves evaluating existing programs, evaluating the effectiveness of programs that are being done either by like social programs, public policy, organizational structures in companies, organizational effectiveness, things of that nature. So, for example, you've got government programs like Head Start, Meals on Wheels, daycare services. Smoking cessation at a corporation, some sort of change management to implement a new process or procedure or technology in a company. All of these different programs, whenever they're implemented, whenever they are created, the folks that are responsible for these programs, one of the things that they put into the design of these programs is an assessment. They have to be assessed for their effectiveness. And, you know, there has to be some sort of measure. So what they want to know is, did the program work? If I'm going to invest, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in this program, I want to know, did it work? There's four general parts, or I guess not, four general things that you do in program evaluation, four different tasks that you do in program evaluation. I'm going to describe each one of them to you. And again, this is something that is, these tasks are, would be very useful skills for you to develop and understand to increase your employability and your usefulness. It helps a lot, trust me. So for example, a needs analysis is done to assess whether there's a need for something. So basically, it assesses if there's individuals who need a particular intervention or program, would use a program if there was one, and can it be sustained, right? So basically, it's an analysis that says, is this intervention, is this program, is this thing needed, right? Is this thing needed? How do you do this? Well, needs analysis are really tough to do. First of all, you have to have data. You've got to first of all identify if there's a need, and for that you need data. You might use census data, surveys, individuals that are in the environment that you're going to be working with, focus groups, community forums. There's lots and lots of different ways, but the bottom line is the needs analysis needs to rely on data. It needs to rely on some sort of inputs and measurements and understandings of the population that you're assessing to see if there is a particular need for something. So, you know, some of the needs analysis that I've been a part of as a consultant have involved assessing, you know, helping companies to assess whether or not they need a particular type of technology, for example. So let's say, for example, that a large pharmaceutical company is looking to see if they need to change their they need to change their technology that they use for managing the production of their drugs. So they have an entire set of technologies that they use to keep track of the manufacture of their drugs, all the way from the chemicals that are being used to cook the drugs, all the way to the shipping and labeling and distribution from A to Z. They are required by law to keep track of every single little step along the way, and maybe they've gotten to the point where they think it's too expensive to do it the way they're doing it, and they're looking to find a way to manage their production and distribution in a much more efficient way. So maybe they would contract consultants to come in and do a needs analysis, to interview people, to look at the way things are done, and to put together a recommendation as to whether or not there is a need to migrate or to change things so that they can do things better, cheaper, and faster, right? That's an example. Another task that's associated with program evaluation is called formative evaluation. So after you've created something, after you've implemented a particular program, you have to be able to assess its functionality. It has to be able to be measured and assessed. So you want to be able to monitor the program while it's running. You want to be able to ask, is the program being implemented the way we planned? Is it being used correctly? Is it being used as planned? Essentially, what you're doing is an audit. You're doing an audit of the program. Once we've audited it and looked at its functioning, does it need fixing or improving? Okay, so a lot of times, for example, pretty much every, you know, every government program, every program that is implemented by nonprofit organizations, they all have this sort of evaluation, this formative evaluation, where somebody has to come in and keep track of the metrics that are used to assess how the program is running and to report back on any changes that need to be made. Big companies do this when they're implementing very large technology changes. You know, they will do it on, they do constant audits and constant metrics, measuring of metrics, and then they check to see if something needs to be fixed or improved. Once again, it's dependent on data. You need to have data, and you need to have, you know, and all of, for a formative evaluation, the data generally needs to be agreed to beforehand. So prior to the implementation of the project, everybody who's implementing the project has to agree that these are the measures that we're going to use to assess success. These are the you know, these are the, you know, whatever number of measures we're going to use to assess whether or not we're being successful or not. Another task that is associated with program evaluation is something called a summative evaluation. That's S-U-M-M-A-T-I-V-E, a summative evaluation. And this is basically an overall assessment of the program's effectiveness. And usually this is done so that people can decide whether to keep the program or end it or to continue to fund it. Most programs that are funded by the federal government go through summative evaluations. Pretty much it's a requirement by law that all programs funded by the federal government go through a summative evaluation. They're assessed to see if they're actually doing what they're supposed to do, and then from there they decide whether or not to kill it or not. I think one of the classic examples from kind of recently was I think back in the 90s, I guess, maybe in the 80s and 90s, there was this DARE program, D-A-R-E, Dare to Do Drugs, that was just an incredibly bad program. It didn't work. And a lot of money was put into it. I mean, a lot of money, because it was a priority of the president or the first lady. I can't remember whose priority it was. I think it was, Reagan or Bush that had this, you know, huge DARE program. And basically it was a program to dissuade, kids from using drugs. And, so it had a lot of advertising money. It had a lot of, money that went to, local law enforcement agencies to go to schools and talk about the dangers of drugs. And when they did the summative evaluations, they found again and again and again and again and again that it didn't work. It wasn't having any effect on the use of drugs across any of the demographics they were looking at. As a matter of fact, I think drug use went up, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong on that, but it wasn't a very effective program. It took a long time for that program to die because the money, there was so much money there, and of course the law enforcement agencies didn't want to lose that money. So so it took quite a while for that program to die, but it was a it was an example of how you know, these summative evaluations, you know, will eventually work. It just, you know, depending on the amount of money involved, sometimes it takes a while. Finally, there's this, the final task associated with program evaluation is cost effectiveness analysis, or put another way, cost benefit analysis. This is a big one. This is one where if you're a consultant, a business consultant, you're going to be doing a lot of these. I've done a lot of these myself. And what a cost benefit analysis is weighing the actual costs of a program and comparing the costs of a program to the benefits or to the effectiveness. So basically what you're doing here is, all right, you know, either before a program is implemented or after a program is implemented, you can do a cost benefit analysis. What you're asking here is it worth, do we get enough benefit given the cost? So if something costs a lot of money, but you're not going to get very much benefit out of it, then obviously you're not going to do it. But on the other hand, if something has a huge benefit and doesn't cost any money, then obviously that's something you'd want to do. Well, usually, right? An example of the latter, of a program that doesn't cost very much money but has a huge benefit, is the Head Start program, where they give poor kids, the ability and the means to start school early on. And they, provide them. And the another program associated with Head Start is with the free breakfast programs and free lunch programs. Those programs are very inexpensive compared to anything else, right? Compared to a lot of other things. They're pretty cheap, but they have huge benefits, huge benefits. I mean, the numbers are staggering when you look at the difference between, little kids that are able to have a free hot breakfast in the morning and versus the ones that have to go to school hungry. They do much better in school and overall in life overall. So, those types of things are very, very easy to measure. The DARE program that I mentioned to you before, that was a very ineffective program, and the cost was very high because Congress had allocated a lot of money for that. So that was, that was a loser at some point. Finally, but they finally cut it because it wasn't very effective, and the cost was very high. The tough ones are going to be like where it's in the middle, where it's like, where it's kind of hard. Well, there's a lot of things that factor into it. First of all, if the cost and benefit are very close to each other, right? If it's really hard to make a decision, right, to tell whether or not there's a true benefit or whether the cost is really that high. One of the things that makes that decision so tough is sometimes it's really hard to quantify benefit. Sometimes it's really hard to quantify the benefit. For example, the benefit of Head Start, that's in some ways that's kind of easy to quantify because you can look at things like grades and whatnot. But, what about the more intangible aspects like, attitudes and, long-term changes in employability, things like that. Those things are kind of hard to get your hands around. One of the classic examples of a benefit being difficult to quantify is, what's the cost benefit of having desks and chairs in your workspace, right? obviously desks and chairs cost some amount of money, right? So we know what the cost is, but what's the benefit? Right. What's the benefit? I mean, how do you quantify that in terms of dollars? Because typically what you're asked to do is to quantify the benefit literally in terms of dollars, in terms of some hard measurable thing like money or hard measurable thing like resources or something like that. And sometimes that's really hard to do, especially when you're talking about social programs. Another example would be the cost benefit analysis of implementing light rail in the San Antonio area. It has been politically very difficult in San Antonio to get that done because the costs are so high. The costs of light rail are very high to build rail networks and get trains and get all that going, right? And not only are the costs high, but the benefits are hard to see. If anyone who's traveled anywhere in the world where there are, good rail networks in a city know the benefits. Rail networks in large cities like San Antonio and Austin bring huge, huge benefits. They make the city more livable. You know, they're good for the economy. There's lots of there's lots of benefits that happen, but they're kind of hard to quantify and put into an accurate prediction. You know, I mean, I can say like, you know, I could say that if we were to implement light rail in San Antonio, in 25 years after that implementation, our city would be better off than it would have been without light rail. That is something that I would bet a lot of money on. But it's hard to say specifically what to predict what the actual measures are going to be, because it's just hard to say. It's just, you know, I can't say that we're going to have this many people employed and this much change to the economy, you know, this many dollars brought into the economy. I you know, that's kind of tough to say with something like light rail. So it's hard to do a cost benefit analysis of light rail sometimes, or of public transportation. Let me back up. It's not hard to do the cost benefit analysis. It's not that hard to do the cost benefit analysis. It's hard to get people to understand it. I think it's harder to get people to go along with the numbers, because it's easy for them to poo poo the numbers and say, oh, that's not true. Anyway, that's the whole lecture. That's everything I wanted to give. So, hope you enjoyed it, and good luck on the final.
Alright, stop what you're doing, cause I'm about to ruin the image and the style that you're used to. I look funny, but yo, I'm making money, see? So yo, world, I hope you're ready for me. Now gather round, I'm the new fool in town, and my sound's laid down by the underground. I drink a bottle of Hennessy you got on your shelf, so just let me introduce myself. My name is Humpty, pronounced with the umpty. Yo, ladies, oh, how I like to funk thee. And all the rappers in the top 10, please allow me to bump thee. I'm stepping tall, y'all, and just like Humpty Dumpty, you're gonna fall when the stereos pump me. I like to rhyme, I like my beats funky, I'm spunky. I like my oatmeal lumpy, I'm sick with this. Straight gangster Mac, but sometimes I get ridiculous. I'll eat up all your crackers and your licorice. Oh, yo, fat girl, come here, are you ticklish? Yeah, I called you fat, look at me, I'm skinny. It never stopped me from getting busy, I'm a freak. I like the girls with the boom. I once got busy in a Burger King bathroom. I'm crazy, allow me to amaze thee. They say I'm ugly, but it just don't faze me. I'm still getting in the girls' pants, and I even got my own dance.
The Humpty Dance is your chance to do it all.
Come on!
Come on, I do the Humpty Hop.
Check me out, y'all.
I do the Humpty Hop.
Just watch me
do the Humpty Hop.
Yeah. Do you know what I'm doing? Doing the Humpty Hop. Come on.
I do the Humpty Hop. I do the Humpty Hop.
People say, yo, Humpty, you're really funny looking. That's alright, cause I get things cooking. You stare, you glare, you constantly try to compare me, but you can't get near me. I'm giving more C, and on the floor B, all the girls, they adore me. Oh yes, ladies, I'm really being sincere, cause in the 69, my Humpty nose will tickle your rear. My nose is big, I'm not ashamed. Big like a pickle, I'm still getting paid. I get laid by the ladies, you know I'm in charge. Both how I'm living and my nose is large. I get stupid, I shoot an arrow like Cupid. I use a word that don't mean nothing, like Luke did. I sang on Do What You Like, and if you missed it, I'm the one who said just grab them in the biscuits. Also told you that I like to bite. Well yeah, I guess it's obvious I also like to write. All you had to do was give Humpty a chance, and now I'm gonna do my dance.
The Humpty Dance is your chance to do the hump.
Come on, yeah, sexy lady,
do the Humpty
Come
hump.
On,
I'll do the Humpty hump.
Break, y'all. Let a little of that bass groove right here. Ah, yeah. Now that I told y'all a little bit about myself, let me tell you a little bit about this dance. It's real easy to do. Check it out. First I limped to the side like my legs was broken, shaking and twitching kinda like I was smoking. Crazy, whack, funky. People say you look like MC Hammer on crack, Humpty. That's alright, cause my body's in motion. It's supposed to look like a fit or a convulsion. Anyone can play this game. This is my dance, y'all. Humpty Hump's my name. No two people will do it the same. You got it down when you appear to be in pain. Humping, funking, jumping, gig around.
around, shaking your rump. And when a doodoo chump punk points a finger like a stunt, tell him step off, I'm doing the hump.
The Humpty Dance is your chance to do the hump.
Everybody,
do me, baby.
I do the Humpty Hump.
Come on,
I do the Humpty Hump.